Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
Then we couldn't see, I couldn't see her because it was ordered a closed casket. So I never really got to say goodbye to her, which was awful. And then again, I mean, maybe it was a good thing and it wasn't the last memory I had of her, whereas my brother has a very different image of her.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next. In Murder in Suburbia, Emily writes about a number of baffling Australian crimes, many of which you've probably never heard of, like the 1984 murder of well-liked suburban mum Nanette Ellis. It's Nanette's ordinariness that makes her unsolved murder so perplexing, although it seems she was the victim of stalking in the weeks before her death. In a moment, we'll talk to her son Craig about the 30th anniversary of Nanette's death, the reward offered for information, and the other mystery that you may be able to help his family find some closure with. But first, my partner in crime, Emily Webb, who's worked at leader newspapers in Melbourne for many years, talks about what it is that drew her to Nanette's case.
It was really funny. There were some real connections that I didn't actually realise when I started to investigate. Like, Nanette actually worked at leader newspapers back in the 1980s. She was the newspaper manager for the newspaper called Free Press Leader that covers the Dandenongs and Belgrave. And I actually worked with people who worked with her back in the 80s. And I actually didn't know that she'd worked at Leader. So when I became a bit intrigued, I live in the outer east of Melbourne, so anything that happens around there, I'm quite fascinated. But what really intrigued me about this case is the police. I ended up getting in contact with the Victoria Police, and by chance, they actually had started reinvestigating it. So I had a bit to do with a really great homicide detective called Kyle Simpson, and he was tasked with reinvestigating Nanette's murder. And Nanette just didn't have anything in her victimology, as they call it, that would suggest that she would be a target for a crime.
That's what they say. I remember talking to Charlie Bazina, the former homicide detective, and he said, get to know your victim first, and more often than not, that will tell you who your perpetrator was. But yeah, with Nanette,
nothing.
Didn't seem to be anyone or anything.
No, she was like a really lovely, beautiful mum, you know, in her, I think she was in her early 40s or might have been 40, and she, the day she was murdered, she'd come home from work and she was going to go out with some girls from work, and there was a window of time, about 45 minutes, where someone came into the house and stabbed her to death and then were gone, and her son actually discovered her, which I just can't even get my head around.
But the lead up was really strange too, wasn't it? A lot of strange things going on in her life.
Coming up, we'll hear about another mystery surrounding Nanette's family that you may be able to help them with. But first, Nanette's son Craig speaks to us about his mother's case and what it's like trying to get on with your life in the middle of a cold case.
It consumes you, so it sort of paralyses you from being social and interacting in a normal way and thinking, just having fun and just relaxing. You just can't do it because you're always thinking, I wonder if that's going to lead to something or not. So it can be quite disruptive. And, you know, I think for most of that 30 years, I've just tried to shelve it, and it's just been my coping mechanism.
That's fair enough. Do you tell people when you meet a new person, how long till you tell them?
Yeah, it's like this big disclosure, and it's kind of almost like you're deemed different because of that, and it shouldn't be. It's not like you've got, even if someone was to have a incurable disease or whatever, it kind of feels like that disclosure that you have to say it at some point.
And
I just remember one relationship I was in that there were people that didn't know, and then my partner at the time was sort of nervous about them knowing. It was kind of quite bizarre, and I had to sort of hold on to it. And I sort of said, well, I can't hold on to it any longer because it's 30 years. It's going to be in the media. You're going to have to tell your friends. So I had to start disclosing to these people about what had happened and what was going to happen. So that was kind of interesting.
All these ripple effects are so fascinating, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because I was just saying to Emily this morning, we see these stories on the news and in the paper and stuff at the time or when there's an anniversary, but we rarely get to catch up with victims' families later and find out how this affects life and relationships. And
I mean, sadly, you hear of people, becoming really dysfunctional, or worse, they're taking their own lives because they just can't cope with the fact there's no closure. I feel privileged that I've been able to sort of rise above and keep going. It must be a constitution in me that allows it. So my mother was quite determined in her own right. I must have got that, I think, from her to keep going and pushing on. And I just don't feel, I just feel like, you know, don't let them win. Don't let this person destroy you as well. And it's sort of hard to kind of rationalize that sometimes. You think, oh God, they've done it. They just, when you have a bad week or something, oh God, they're killing me too. You know? I don't often feel like that. I think there's enough in my life to keep me. I've got children and, you know, a good job and nice friends and stuff, and there's it sort of snaps me out of that. But if I didn't have that around me, it would be very isolating.
Did you find yourself being suspicious of people in your life and her life? And
yeah, I think that's definitely changed me in that sense, that I sort of I don't get to know people really well quickly. It takes a while, so I can have like a superficial relationship with someone, or on the surface, when you say superficial, on the surface, but I won't let it get too close until I'm really sure about them.
Are you do you have a level of fear because somebody?
I think I just want to know, firstly, what sort of person are they, and are they able to cope with that disclosure? And it's, you know, it's a tragic thing to disclose, and I think any compassionate human being would be compassionate about that. So I think once I establish that I've got that trust with them and I'd have that support, I mean, there are people that I've told that have sort of brushed it off and sort of said, oh, you just got to move on and things like that.
Wow.
In a way, and, you know, at the same time, I can kind of think, yes, I have moved on, but it's still there and I'd like it solved. And I think everyone in my family's been sort of deprived of a person in their life with Nanette. So, you know, my kids haven't had a grandmother growing up. We've had, other people in my grandmother, Nanette's mother she sort of stepped into that nurturing role when I was 18, and she did a great job. But, you know, she was older and she took on a lot. She was amazing. And but, you know, sadly she's passed away. And it really did affect her. Her life was changed. You know, she suffered with some depression and stuff like that as a result.
Samantha, you're one of those children who grew up without a grandmother. Have you coped with this disclosure, this element of having this story as part of your life and family, and when to tell people?
Well, I'm 25 now, so at an earlier time in my life, it was something I didn't really understand. I knew about it, however, I didn't understand the intensity or the reality of it.
Yeah.
So I think now, as an adult, it really hits home.
Were you raised, do you think, with a fear?
Possibly, yeah. Being younger, I didn't quite understand it. I always wondered why Mum and Dad, well, particularly Dad, was quite protective over me and worried when I would walk the streets either alone or with a small group of friends. And even now, as an adult, being in my own home, I don't feel safe at times because I know what's happened.
That Nanette was in her own home.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. How do you raise daughters when this has happened to your mum? It must have been terrifying.
Yeah, it was highly vigilant. You're sort of on guard. And I think that's part of the change in my personality. I've become very on guard about things and very just really aware of my environment. And I don't want to be around dysfunctional people that are like ticking time bombs. You know, like I would avoid going to a club or a pub. I mean, although I have done it, but then the minute it starts getting messy and people getting, you know, silly and nasty with each other and trouble starts, I really freak out. And I just want to get out of there.
Yeah. Wow.
I just don't like, I just think people think they're so invincible these days and that they things can't happen to them and their lives, it's like, you know, people being king hit in King's Cross, for instance. You know, like they go, young kid going out innocently and he's dead because someone's decided to hit him. You know, so people, life just gets taken so quickly, and I just think, you know, it's just, you've just got to value your life and just sort of take yourself out of those situations as much as you can. So protecting yourself, that's how I feel.
And it also, this intriguing part of your mother's story is that was she in a situation without even knowing it? Because there was this sort of stalking behaviour that she was living through before she died, do you think that those... that they're connected? Do you think that she was actually living in a very dangerous situation almost without knowing?
I mean, that's possible. I mean, they've talked about all different scenarios.
Can you tell us about what had been going on in the weeks before? Because you'd been, staying with your mum, very protective.
Yeah. So, yes, I mean, the first event was a broken windscreen. Random can happen to anyone, right? So in the days, they didn't have laminated screens in many cars, so the whole thing shattered. It was quite a traumatic thing. She couldn't see where she was going.
So did
punch a hole.
That happened while she was driving?
While she was driving. So
someone threw something at it.
Belgrave, Mombok Road. So Burwood Highway continues up in past National Park, sort of up to Belgrave. And on that bend, somewhere there, a rock hit the windscreen and shattered. So she went over to the side. That's fine. Called and had the car taken away, and that was not thought of. Again, that was fine, terrible, but, you know, happened. Mm-hmm. 2 days later, same stretch of road, bang, another windscreen broken. Rock went right through. Actually, I might have got this wrong. I think the second one might have been the rock went through the radiator, and smashed the radiator and lost water. And then she wasn't aware of that straight away, that the damage to the car. She was coming down the mountain from Belgrave to Furniture Gully direction. And then by the time she got to the Burvale Hotel there, the car was boiling. So she was up on the median strip. You know, I think she called me and said, oh, the car's boiled, whatever.
It was a fairly new car too, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it wasn't like it was lack of maintenance, of course.
No.
So, yeah, it was quickly worked
out. And you realised it had been smashed, the radiator?
Yeah, went down to see her and you could see the rock was still sitting behind the grill.
Ah.
Like, for a rock, like a rock off a railway line track. So the car got towed to my father's service station in Toorak Road, who he's a mechanic, and he helped her get it sorted out. So that was okay. That was that episode. Then I think a day or 2 days later, again, another broken windscreen on the same stretch of road. Rock came right in this time, took a chip out of the dashboard and landed on the back seat. So I think at this point, she said, you know, someone's trying to run me off the road. This is just weird, you know, within a week. So that got repaired. And then I'd come home one night from being out and her car, I think, actually I might have it around the wrong way anyway, but there was a tin of paint tipped over her car. Mm. May have been the first instance or the last. Isn't it just extraordinary how the sequence is now skewed?
Yeah.
I could go back through my statements and see it, but you know.
Yeah.
But a tin of paint poured over her car and I came home and I thought, what's that? And I didn't hear anyone, you know. Went down to the shed. I'll get some terps. I said, no, it's all right. It's water-based. We'll hose it off. So we did that. The next day I polished it, cleaned the car up beautiful. She was really happy about that. And then I think the next night I came home and the car, she parked it down the side of the driveway so she could keep an eye on it more. And it was all sitting skew-if and the number plate was missing and I'm thinking, what's going on? And got out and I could hear hissing, like one of the tyres was still going down. So they'd all been slashed, the tyres, and the aerial had been ripped off and the wipers bent up. And then the number plate just torn from the car, like the screws had been pulled through the number plate, and that was laying in the neighbour's garden.
Terrifying.
Terrifying. So I'm standing at, like, they wouldn't have long been gone.
No.
Shit. So I went inside and she said, oh, I didn't hear anything. Actually, she was listening to music with these headphones on in the days. Didn't hear anything. And she was quite distraught then. Went to the neighbour. He came out and she was sort of he was sympathetic, and we called the police. And so that's all that damage to the car occurred. And then there was nothing once the tyres were fixed. And I've got it in the right sequence because the tyres and the paint was the last thing. So the rocks were the first thing. Paint and tyres were the last thing. And then there was the next day I said to Nanette, just stay home, stay inside, lock the doors. The police knew and everything. And I'm going to take, I jacked the car up and took wheels off and had tyres fitted, you know, brand new tyres and stuff. Got the car fixed up. Everything was good. I think Thursday night, I remember her saying to me, let's go for a drive. I was on L's, I think. It was on L's. No, it was on P plates. That's right. I just got my license. And she said, oh, the car's so much better to drive. Those tyres are much better than the other ones, whatever. Why don't you, we go and get something for dinner, have an easy dinner. We'll go and get barbecue chicken and stuff, and you can drive. So I drove her car. I said, yeah, it's really good. So that was a nice night. And then on the Friday, she said, oh, Friday, I think I had a phone call while I was there, and I was home with my car doing an old classic Holden, which I was restoring, and I was putting stuff back on it, and no mobiles, and I could hear the phone ringing, you know, and ran in, hello, she was on a lunch break, everything all right, yeah, good, oh yeah, I think it's all over now, it's all good, and I'm going out with the girls tonight, and I'm getting picked up at 6, I said, oh, that's really good, and all right, well, I said, well, I'm going to the drive-in with the boys, and, you know, oh, what are you going to go and see, and I said, oh, we're going to go and see Mortuary, and I said, oh, and I thought later, oh, my God, you know. Of course, I never went to the drive-in because I returned home to get showered and changed later and found, you know, my brother crying in the driveway with a neighbour. You know, it's too late. And I said, what's happened? And I said, oh, it's your mum, you know, she's gone, she's gone. I said, what's happened to her? And I don't know whether he said she's been stabbed. I don't know how he would know that, whether he said that or not, I don't know. But he said, she's gone, she's cold, don't go around there, please don't go around their back. So I didn't. I just got in the car and drove off to get my friends to come and stuff like that. So that was, wow. I'll never forget that.
The police weren't there yet?
No, they weren't. No, they weren't there yet, no. So it just, it was in that window where they'd been called,
yeah,
but hadn't arrived. But when I got back, when I got to my friends, you know, I got my friend to call the house and they said, tell him to come back. Your mother's all right. And I'm thinking, oh. Whether they thought it was me or whatever, I don't know, but to get me back, you know. And they told me that she was deceased and it was just horrendous. We were just bundled into cars and taken to St Kilda Road and questioned, it seemed like, all night. Mm. Unrelenting. It was just fingerprints over. But you said this, you said that.
Oh, God.
We're all treated the same. My father, how did you get the scratches on your arms? And I mean, they've got to be like that, I know, yeah, but it was horrendous.
You feel horrible, like yeah, this trauma you're going through. Mm. And you.
Then we couldn't see. I couldn't see her because it was ordered a closed casket. So I never really got to say goodbye to her, which was awful. And yeah, then again, I mean, maybe it was a good thing and it wasn't the last memory I had of her, whereas my brother has a very different image of her. Mm. But yeah, that was that's where it all changed. And I just remember being in a state of shock for weeks and losing so much weight. And I think just having diarrhea and not eating, I was down. I don't know what weight I was, but probably whatever a 26-inch waist is, I was that.
Pretty skinny.
Yeah, horrendous. And you're just like in twilight zone. And didn't want to go to work. I didn't want to work with knives anymore because I was a chef.
Oh my God! Yeah.
It was just all of that stuff.
Did you have counselling?
Not a lot. I had went to a forensic psychologist. I think it was Ian Joblin at the time.
This is what I'm learning, because I always had this silly assumption that families in your situation were immediately sent to counselling, were given assistance, were, you know, that somebody paid attention to you and how you were travelling and made sure you were supported. I didn't realise that.
Yeah, very, very little. I mean, it was just that initial consult with Ian Joblin. Mm. He was the forensic psychologist. But no, I mean, if you wanted more, you had to just pay for it and do it. And Greg did, my brother, but I chose not to. I felt like I could deal with it. But it wasn't offered to me like, there was no one coming to me and saying, look, we're offering this for you for as long as you need it. as part of a
conversation. What would happen today?
Yeah, there was none of that. None of that for any of us, really. But my brother, because of him finding my mother, it was that if it can be any worse, it was worse for him, I think, in that sense. Mm. But, yeah. I mean, I've probably had a few sessions later on in life that, you know, you get to a point where you have things build up in your life that, you know, can be that's a major, and you have all these things that happen on top of that, and you have a point in which you just melt down.
I bet.
So I had one meltdown.
Mm.
You know, so I was like so depressed, I couldn't get out of bed. I'm thinking, oh, this, I can't. And everything was so much worse, seemed so much worse. Mm. It was just one thing on the top of the other. You know, you have that, and you have a marriage breakdown, and you have, you know, there was lots of different things. So I went through that period, but I came out of it stronger, I think, and I survived it. Some people don't survive that. That can be enough to tip them over.
I suppose I should ask about your dad. I think listeners will be saying, "Who's? Hang on a minute, we're missing someone."
Yeah. You know, they were a great match in the beginning, you know. He just adored her, and I'm sure she did he. But he, and, you know, if my stepmother was listening and I said that my father had a drinking problem, she wouldn't be very happy about it.
Okay, fair enough.
But basically that was the beginning of the end, I think, once he started with the drink. You know, that culture of going to work, knocking off, meeting your mates, coming home, you'd drink and drive, and she used to say, oh, he's home, you know, and he'd be nitpicky, and he was quite verbally abusive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it
but how was their divorced relationship? Was it sort of friendly? And
well, it became, they at least made an effort, and they were civil to one another, but if he'd decided to go on a bender and started coming around with pizzas banging on the door at night, she might have to call the police, you know. So, of course, when this happened, everyone in the family, oh, it's got to be him. It's
yes.
Got to be him.
Well, not only the family. I mean, that's the common investigative assumption, isn't it? They go straight for the partner or the ex-partner or...
Yeah. But, you know, he was DNA tested and all the rest of it, and it was ruled out. So that was one good thing in moving forward with the DNA technology. They were able to actually rule him out with DNA.
Yeah.
They took a swab from him
while
he was alive. And, yeah, it was nice because it was a niggling thing for me. Yeah. And then I, at the time, didn't want to live with him, only because I wasn't sure who – I didn't know who did it, and I still don't. But, you know, it would be horrible, wouldn't it, to think you've gone and lived with your – parent and then found out later it was them that's caused all this and did this. So, but it wasn't. But at the time I chose to live with friends for several months and what happened? I think I went into a relationship really early because it was a safety net thing, and I think that was another mistake because, you know, it was shelter and normality and, you know, so the first person that showed me any hint of that security, I think I jumped at. So, again, that relationship for me wasn't really the best. Although, you know, we're on good terms too, and I've got two beautiful kids. So it's not – it was a positive thing really, but
I can't imagine it would be easy to be in a relationship with a man whose mum has been murdered and there's been no closure about who perpetrated it.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. You must have gone through so many emotions, ups and downs, ins and outs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think would it have been hard to love you, to be your
partner? So. I think so. I think I became very distant, and I'd sort of just be off thinking, and you know, hello, and yeah, I'd be thinking about. But I'm less like that now. But even things like this can stir that up a little bit for me. But I think I'm getting better at just realizing, I'm getting older now, and I just want to live the rest of my life as happy as I can be without this psychological disruption of what happened to Nanette, and without turning my back on it. I mean, I'm 100% there, but I have to weigh it up and think, is this the right thing to do? And I think with this sort of interview, it's just I just would appeal to someone out there that knows something, you know, come on, it's time just to, it's possible they're getting on a bit too in life. Do they want to take this to their grave and let us to continue to suffer? I mean, just to have someone accountable now would be such a turning point for everyone.
Yeah.
And even Nanette's sister, who, you know, had to look after all the affairs. She was executrix after Nanette passed away, and packing up all her stuff, packing up her house. At that time, they didn't even supply cleaning of the crime scene, you know.
Oh, my God.
So
she had, to clean the crime scene?
With her partner, and her partner said he'd do it. So they went and hired a steam cleaner, and it was just horrendous. You know, like, you're never going to clean it properly. So she went through a lot, and she'd said to me the last year or so that I was never offered any counselling. I never had anything, you know. And she's sort of become quite, holds her cards close to her heart and chest, and she doesn't really, she's not a very affectionate person. She's selective, but I believe she has issues with her boys, you know, getting on with them. So I don't know whether or not that's got something to do with just the ripple effect of her sister being taken like that. And they were quite close. So, you know, she went through all that stuff, and having to sort of cope with all the aftermath of, you know, my brother was still very angry, of course, and so was I, but I really got on well with my aunt, but my brother chose to go the other way and hated her, and was, you know, she had a hard time with him, so that's damaged that relationship, so they don't talk. So there's definitely those flow on the ripple effects that affect people.
Yeah, and I think that's important to know as well, that if anyone does know anything, that just because it was 32 years ago doesn't mean there's still not people suffering and that you could end it.
Yeah, I mean, I really, when I hear on the news that, oh, cold case has been solved, I just think, oh, are they going to say Nanette? But I'm thinking, don't be stupid. They tell me that something was coming. But then again, stranger things have happened. So that always makes my ears prick up, and I think that's how wonderful they're getting that closure. I wish I could get that. And yet Homicide were quietly confident in a sense that they were going to get some closure with that last media thing at 30 years, because we did, what did we do? We did, well, television. We did some news.
You did an interview appeal.
Channel 10, 7, was it?
You did a magazine interview.
Magazine with, right, yeah.
And it's a big reward, and often they say, you know, it does take a big money reward sometimes to flush out something. Was that hard for you when there was not very much publicity, and then it coming up, because people are very interested in cold cases and ones they haven't heard of? Was that difficult?
Yeah,
now?
I think that space of time, you know, you're talking 28 years or something where there hasn't been much, then bang, it's all on. Everyone wants to know about it. You know, you're getting phone calls from people wanting to talk about it. It was quite exhausting and overwhelming. But at the time, I just remember being shielded, going into a milk bar. You know, the days they used to put the Herald Sun thing out. You know, they'd have the front page, wouldn't they? Just in the front, in a little cage thing. And we walked into a, we were over at my aunt's, in my nana's sister in Bentley, and we'd gone down the shop. We're all sort of drugged up on whatever to keep us calm. And as we're walking in, here's the picture of Nanette. You know, whatever it said, the headline. And I looked, and my brother looked, and my aunt said, "Don't look, don't look, just keep walking." It was just like an absolute nightmare.
Yeah.
And we got into that shop, and we got in the car, we're all crying, and you know, and then she said, "Oh, it's all right, I'll call the doctor, and he'll come over and he'll give us some Mogadon. We'll go for a sleep." So he knocked us all out, because we hadn't slept all night. And I just remember my grandmother was in the bedroom with a face washer on her head, because she was so just shocked. And it was just, you know, and I remember getting pulled over in the car for speeding, and I said to the police, "Oh, my mother's been murdered," and, you know, and, "Oh, what's her name? And, "Oh, are you going straight home?" Well, they checked. They said, "Are you going straight home?" And I said, you shouldn't really be driving, and you should, you know, whatever. So they let me off. But it just stuff like that, you know, you never think you'd be telling a police officer that.
Your brother Greg, how's he travelling? I'm not going to ask you to speak for Greg, but Greg, I believe, found your mum on the day.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine. I don't know where to start to ask questions. Is Greg okay, basically, I guess?
Well, I think he is. He lives in Japan now, so he's been there for 20 years. So he just ran away, really. Okay. So he lives there. And, look, he's doing really well. And he's married to a Japanese girl, got two kids who are grown up, and one's studying law and the other's still at school, uni. But I'm sure he still suffers. And I think... I'm sure he still suffers. I know that he had counselling for a long time as well, as I did. But
so do you talk? You're close? You and Greg?
We're close. I mean, not as close as we used to be.
Yeah.
I think the whole family kind of disbanded in a sense. People sort of retracted into their own lives, and I mean, I do hear from some people, but not close, and things don't happen often, you know, catch up. Some people don't survive that. That can be enough to tip them over. Mm. But,
I'm so sorry for your loss, and I really appreciate you coming in and talking about it. I hope that, you know, I'm not going to suggest for a minute that it would have helped, but I hope it doesn't, you know, trouble you to have spoken about
it
again. That's
fine, because I think, as I said earlier, it's a positive. I think it's a positive thing. I weigh these things up. I wouldn't just do it for the... I think... You know, because of the coverage that you would have with this podcast, mm-hmm. is it?
Yep.
That people who are genuinely interested would be listening, I guess, and that it just takes that one person. And over time, relationships change. People fall out with people.
Yep.
For different reasons.
Yep.
You know, and they might think, oh, that bastard. Well, they know it was a man that did it.
Okay.
That bastard, his time, he, you know, served his... Dues there.
Someone may not be needing to give that person an alibi, yeah, or
that's
you
right.
know.
But even if they've, it's possible they're deceased. I mean, so in that, it doesn't matter. I mean, if they can be identified and they can match DNA to prove that mm-hmm. in some way. I mean, there's they can do linear matches with family members and stuff to ascertain was it them or not. There's ways they can do it, and I don't know, but. You know, just because they're deceased, they shouldn't let that deter them.
No. Yeah. Well, that's what I mean, and should really be focused on the fact that you're still living with it. The family is still suffering, so it's not over. That's Craig Ellis, son of unsolved murder victim Nanette Ellis, and if you have any information about the case, please call Crime Stoppers on 1800 333 000 or visit their website. But before we go, there's actually another mystery we're hoping one of our listeners may be able to help Craig out with. I'll let him explain. It subsequently came to light that your mum had had another baby before you guys.
That's
and,
right.
And that baby had been adopted out. Mm-hmm. What a time and what a way to sort of find out that that's part of your family background.
Yeah.
Are you guys still in touch? Is there a relationship with...
Yeah, I've got a very close relationship with Janet.
Wow,
and,
great.
And it's been lovely to be reunited. Mm. And she's never felt sort of 100% relaxed or a sense of belonging with her adoptive family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just didn't really work out for her. And then I know that Nanette was actually looking for her.
Wow.
When she was alive, and Janet was looking for her too at different times. But she sort of she was a nurse, and she sort of you know, she was going to uni and training, and she'd sort of drop out and go back, and she had it was a very tumultuous time with that because she was just so, you know, just wanted to find her mother. And I know that Nanette sometimes seemed troubled, like she was thinking about something, and you'd be talking to her and she's probably thinking about Janet. And I know that my grandmother had said that in early days that Nanette would sort of look at prams and think, is that my daughter? Mm. But I mean, there's other circumstances around the adoption that it wasn't exactly Nanette's choice. It was that time where, you know, I think her father demanded it happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, it happened just through, you could just do it through the doctor.
Mm.
And then her parents ended up being quite elderly to take on, or, you know, advanced in age to be taking on a baby. I mean, they were well into their 50s and, you know.
Janet's adoptive parents.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
At that time. So, okay. Of course, they died quite early on.
Yeah.
And I think the mother got Alzheimer's and she was quite abusive to her as well. So, yes, that was another. I mean, I found out about Janet probably 2 years after my mother's death, and my grandmother just produced this birth certificate and sat me down and said, "There's something I need to tell you." And I didn't ever think I'd be the one to have to do this, but you have a sister, half sister, and this is what happened. And you know, the guy wanted to marry her, but your grandfather wouldn't allow it, and you know, ordered him away, and probably I think thumped him or something. So you know, it was just a crazy And apparently this Peter guy just adored her. But
he would have known her when she was, you know, known a lot about her that you don't know
And then
about.
It's sister who, she recently said, oh, I remember Peter. Yeah, he had blonde hair and blue eyes. I remember he was really nice. So, you know, you can see where the genes have come from for Janet. And he was really supportive, wanted to marry. I think because he was Latvian, there was a bit of discrimination even, you know. But I don't know why. Not these days, it wouldn't be, but it was just a bit sad for her. Mm. And he, I believe, and I don't know how I knew this, that he got married and he's got kids of his own, three, and they're obviously grown up now. And I don't know how, you know, at the time we were told this information, then they've gone through the records now with the cold case. No, there's no record of his surname or anything about him. But we were told that he'd been spoken to and, you know, he's married with three kids and whatever they needed to talk to him about, they did. And he was eliminated. So his name's Peter and he's Latvian. And
when was Janet born?
So she was born on the 21st of October, 1961.
So Peter would have been from what area did Nanette grow up in?
Well, I believe that when she had the baby, she was in Box Hill, in New Street, Box Hill, in 1961, and had the baby. You know, that's where the baby was adopted from and whatever.
Huh.
And then Janet, then the adoptive parents were in Mount Albert.
If you have any information about Peter, please drop us a line on our Facebook page, Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. If you like reading about Australian true crime, be sure to pick up our very own Emily Webb's books, Murder in Suburbia, Suburban Nightmare and Angels of Death. Thank you to Sherry Laurie, Michael Davran, Kieran Simpson and Alex Loran for their help in pulling this project together. We'll be back with more Australian true crime next week.